Coming up on our show today, we're going to look at two different situations. The first one having to do with the vindictive prosecution of Kilmar Armando Obrego Garcia. And the second issue, we'll be talking about the Israel's attack on the flotilla and a claim by a person called Kurnow Damo on the internet that that this attack on the flotilla has backfired because Colombia has come out swinging. And then finally, we'll hear a song by my brother, Paul Tinker Hess, related to democracy and the struggle to produce a democratic society. So first, we're going to begin with an examination of probable prosecutorial misconduct by the Trump administration with regard to the deportation case brought against a Salvadorian man, Kilmar Armando Obrego Garcia, who was living legally in the United States and who was illegally deported in March of this year by the U.S. government under the Trump administration, which called it an administrative error. At the time, Obrego Garcia had never been charged with or convicted of a crime in either the United States or his native country, El Salvador. But despite this fact, he was imprisoned without trial in the Salvadorian Terrorism Confinement Center called SECOAT. His case became the most prominent of the hundreds of migrants the U.S. sent to be jailed without trial in that maximum security prison in El Salvador under a financial arrangement between the MAGA U.S. government and the far right-wing government of El Salvador, where the U.S. pays the Salvadorian government to imprison U.S. deportees there. The administration defended the deportation of Garcia. They accused him of being a member of the Salvadorian gang MS-13, which is a U.S. designated terrorist organization, and that was based on a determination made during the 2019 immigration court bail proceeding. Obrego Garcia has denied the allegation that he was a member of that gang. We will be listening here to an episode of a podcast by Allison Gill and Adam Classfield. Classfield has been closely following the prosecutorial legal maneuvers of the Trump administration. And although the U.S. Supreme Court has given the Trump administration certain successes in obtaining at least temporary permission to pursue its Project 2025 priorities, it has run into certain difficulties with regard to its mass deportation program. For example, the Supreme Court has declared that everyone in the U.S. is supposed to receive the right of due process, even non-citizens. This is a crucial firebreak in any autocrat's attempt to crash our entire constitutional system in one blow by throwing red meat to those of the general public who may have natural inclinations in the autocrat's favor. But without due process, we do not have a democracy and we do not have a constitutional government. We have a tribal government, in my opinion, and that's what we have here in many aspects, and it is being tested in many ways. To those of us who have been trying to engage the issues around the actions of the Trump administration, and to those who are finding it ever more interesting just to keep an eye on what is actually going on, I will encourage everyone to keep an eye on the upcoming applications of international law with regard to Israel and with regard to Israel's allies. The war criminals within various of the governments of the world are presently and will be in the future under the onus of their guilt. This is as it should be, and thankfully, it represents vulnerabilities to their operations. I recommend everyone to keep an eye on these vulnerabilities, such as the genocide currently being executed against Palestinian civilians in Gaza, and the criminality of ethnic cleansing of the West Bank. But another vulnerability of the Trump administration is its conflict with the other two branches of government, the Congress and the courts. Obviously, at present, the Trump administration has the Republicans in Congress, apparently as captives, apparently bound to his authoritarian style by some primitive tribal force, nationalism of some white or beige variety. This situation may be expected to swing wildly from one extreme to the other due to reactive forces from both the left and the right. This is the pendulum effect in politics. So keep an eye on Trump's vulnerabilities and the vulnerabilities of his government and its relationship to the other two branches, which could change quite radically after the election next year in November. So, in the show coming up, we'll hear about one of the vulnerabilities of the Trump Department of Justice that it created for itself by aggressively and vindictively persecuting Kilmer Armando Abrego Garcia. So, here is the discussion by Allison Gill and Adam Classfield.
As everybody comes in, A, thank you. B, a special thanks to Adam Classfeld, who, as you will see, is the walking wounded, is joining us. Even like when I say there's a level of dedication that comes from Adam Classfeld that cannot be appreciated until you have the Classfeld experience. This is what I'm talking about. The guy just getting back from getting checked out. And he's here on a Substack Live. And to his credit, he's the one who brought this breaking news to my attention. And Adam and I said, let's jump on Substack Live. Let's get all of these folks caught up on this huge news. So first of all, Adam, I'm glad you're okay. Second of all, thanks for being so on top of things. Adam, we have entitled this Breaking News on Kilmer Abrego Garcia's Case. Give us the latest.
The breaking news is that a federal judge has called for an evidentiary hearing to determine whether Kilmer Abrego Garcia has been vindictively prosecuted. Now, even getting to that stage is extraordinary.
Huge.
I have never seen, you know, it's been 20 years on the legal beat covering a lot of cases. And
too young for 20 years, Adam.
But I've never seen a judge say that a criminal defendant has carried his or her burden to the point where they would call for an evidentiary hearing. And the evidence rattled out in this 16-page opinion is, you know, it's a unique set of facts, folks. You know, we're at 700 people who are live with us right now. Folks have seen the way this case has panned out from the beginning of March, when Abrego was hustled out of the country in defiance of a court order. And the entire narration is part of this ruling as to the evidence of why the judge has ordered that he can pursue discovery into whether he's been vindictively prosecuted and entitled to an evidentiary hearing. This will come to hearings.
Let me stop you for one hot second before we get into the real meat of it. Let's get everybody caught up on the legal basis by which Kilmer Abrego Garcia even got to this point, as cited in the judge's order, to prove this theory of actual vindictiveness. A defendant like Abrego Garcia can get a dismissal through the presentation of, quote, objective evidence that a prosecutor acted in order to punish the defendant for standing on his legal rights. If the defendant presents evidence of a reasonable likelihood, and that's the legal standard, a reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness, then the district court must, not may, must allow discovery and an evidentiary hearing on that issue. So, Adam, What did Kilmer tee up for the judge's consideration to even get the evidentiary hearing and the discovery to get to that point?
So for Judge Crenshaw, I think the most convincing piece of evidence was they teed up a clip on Fox of Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche saying that we, in sum and substance, we needed to move forward with investigating this because a judge in Maryland questioned our decision to hustle him out of the country to a terrorism prison in El Salvador in defiance of a court order. More specifically, and this is a direct quote from the ruling here, that strikingly, the judge writes, during a television interview, Deputy Attorney General Blanche revealed that the government started investigating Abrego after, quote, a judge in Maryland questioned the government's decision, found it had no right to deport him, and accused the government of doing something wrong. So that goes to the heart of what the vindictive prosecution standard is. The vindictive prosecution is you are going after this criminal defendant because that person stood up for their rights. And there Todd Blanche is articulating that standard on Fox. It was something that just teed it up directly for the judge. And there were other recitations of the evidence. Christy Noem going out and trashing Kilmer Abrego Garcia every chance that she gets over things that he is not even accused of. There's a litany of evidence, but that was the one that, if you're reading this ruling, that's the one that was most striking to the judge to get it to that stage. Also, the timeline, and we can go into that as well.
Yeah, so before we get into the timeline, what's delicious about this federal judge's order is a citation to a case that stands for the proposition that, quote, actual confession by the prosecutor is the clearest case of prosecutorial vindictiveness. So, Adam, we know that Noem, Blanche, Pamela, Joe, all of them can't miss a photo op, as I like to say. And clearly, when they speak, it comes to bite them back in the ass. For example, Judge Crenshaw says that to remove any doubt, Deputy Attorney General Blanche said that the criminal case was brought to return Abrego to the United States, not because of a judge, but instead because of an arrest warrant issued by a grand jury in the Middle District of Tennessee. This could be direct evidence of vindictiveness, right? I mean, there's a whole theory that's here. So you mentioned a timeline. So the judge in this case said that there's not only the factual timeline, but there are kind of three discrete kind of areas of time that the court is identifying that provides context for Abrego Garcia's request to not only do the discovery in this case, but to get his evidentiary hearing. And the judge focuses on November of 2022, which is when he was traffic stopped in Tennessee, and he was let go. And right. There was no referral, no criminal case, nothing happened. The second timeline was time frame was March of 2025, just a few months ago, when the United States removed Kilmer, quote, due to an admitted administrative error by the United States. And all of those, and she calls them the executive official defendants, made all those horrible statements about him, calling him a gang member, a violent criminal, and a terrorist with no factual evidence. And then the last time frame is April of 2025, that after the Supreme Court affirmed the injunction in favor of Mr. Abrego Garcia, suddenly Homeland Security decides to reopen an investigation into a 2022 traffic stop of Mr. Abrego Garcia. I mean, Adam, on its face, you don't have to be Clarence Darrow to see that this screams of vindictive prosecution of this poor man.
Right. I mean, this one of the big question marks over this case is what teeth does vindictive prosecution as a motion have? If this set of facts can't lead to an evidentiary hearing, what can? So I think today is very significant, not only for Kilmer Abrego Garcia, it's significant for James Comey. It is, it is significant for LaMonica McGyver in the District of New Jersey. Not that it has a precedential weight, but that other judges will see how judges are applying the vindictive prosecution standard in the age of Trump. Is this some theoretical idea that safeguards vindictive prosecution? Or when the government flagrantly and shamelessly goes on Fox or some other or on Twitter or on, you know, Trump's platform and says the essentially the legal basis to get this out the door, will the judge look the other way? Or will this move forward? And this is a first sign that says the courts, yes, the vindictive prosecution is a prohibition that courts are willing to enforce. So it's Adam,
Adam, remind people, because poor Kilmer Abrego Garcia has multiple cases. So remind people as to which judge in which case this order is applying to.
So this is in the criminal case in the Middle District of Tennessee. This is Judge Waverly Crenshaw, who is presiding over the criminal trial. He's one of the judges who found that the government didn't meet its burden to detain Abrego. And so he has ruled that this is going to go forward. Now, this could have some resonance in a civil case that's going to a hearing on Monday before Judge Paula Zinis over in Maryland. Yes, because right now, Abrego, after being in criminal detention, released from criminal detention, was put in immigration detention. And the government is trying to deport him right now to Eswatini, which, trivia fact, is the last absolute monarchy in the African continent and has publicly stated that they had never heard anything directly from the U.S. government saying that they were going to send Abrego there. And anyone that the U.S. government sends there, pursuant to their more than $1 million contract with the United States, is going to be repatriated to the home country. So here's where things stand in Maryland. Because the government is going, what Abrego's legal team is saying there in that habeas corpus case is the government does not have the legal right to send him to, if they send him to Eswatini, Eswatini will send him back to El Salvador, and that's what is known as a chain deportation. It would be trying to sidestep the very prohibition that the government is facing. So when the Trump government sent Abrego to El Salvador, they had violated a court order. They're arguing that this violates a court order, and therefore Abrego should be released from immigration detention because they don't have a real plan to send him out of the country right now. So they're fighting a battle on two fronts. One, they are trying to fight against this criminal case in Nashville, which, for all the muddying of the waters that Christy Noem and others are doing, he's charged with smuggling, not trafficking. They always say trafficking. The difference between that is the 2-decade sentence that Ghislaine Maxwell has versus the average sentence for smuggling is about 1 year in the Middle District of Tennessee. So they are trying to fight against those smuggling charges or that result from that 2022 traffic stop, which, as you said, Katie, he was let out without even a speeding ticket. And it recently came to light in court papers that this was investigated by Homeland Security. That 2022 traffic stop, they found nothing. Despite a full 2022 investigation by Homeland Security itself. And we can talk about the weaknesses of the case that have emerged in the pretrial proceedings already. But what this is basically coming down to is a significant legal victory in the criminal case. And we'll see on Monday where things stand in the civil case, where the request that's on the table right now is whether he can be released from immigration detention as well.
Yeah. So let's unpack that for people, because admittedly, it's a lot of moving parts, right? So if everybody will recall, Kilmer Abrego Garcia kind of was a juggernaut coming into the top of the public discourse after he was illegally sent to CECOT, that horrific torture prison in El Salvador, in violation of an immigration order. Now, remember, Abrego Garcia went through the immigration system. A judge at the conclusion of a hearing determined that he, because he would face the risk of harm, violence, death, and persecution if he got sent back to El Salvador, that he wasn't supposed to be sent back to El Salvador. We find out that what? A DOJ lawyer says it was an accident, an administrative error to have Kilmer Abrego Garcia sent to CECOT. What's happened to that lawyer, Adam, at DOJ who made that confession to the court?
He was sacked. He was fired. Anytime the Trump administration, when they have a lawyer who tells the truth that reflects badly on their agenda in federal court, when they fulfill their obligation to have candor with the court, they lose their jobs. So that's what happened to that particular former DOJ lawyer turned whistleblower against Emil Bovey, who went. He's the same former DOJ attorney, Erez Ruveni, who had said that Emil Bovey had called that meeting where he instructed his prosecutors that they might have to start saying "fuck you" to the courts. That's a direct quote. What came out right before the Senate Republicans confirmed Mr. Bovey as a Third Circuit lifetime appointee of the Court of Appeals.
So that DOJ lawyer gets sacked, as Adam just summarized. And as a result of that illegal removal of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, y'all will remember there was a habeas case that was begun in Maryland, and that is who Judge Paula Zenas is that Adam's been referring to. And that is the case that led to the Supreme Court of the United States issuing a 9-0 ruling describing what would constitute notice, due process, opportunity to be heard in that situation, right? Okay. So what happens, as Adam just also explained a couple of minutes ago, Kilmer Abrego Garcia is rotting in that prison in El Salvador, despite everybody's protestations and attempts to get him back. And then suddenly, after the Supreme Court says, can't do this, Trump administration. You didn't give him notice and opportunity to be heard. You violated his due process. They suddenly find this investigation has to be reopened, and they suddenly find this indictment to charge him with, quote, trafficking, as Adam explained, from that 2022 traffic stop that was occurring years ago, and nothing came to fruition. And that kind of sets the table, if you will, for this challenge. So that's the reason why we're seeing parallel cases, folks. The Maryland, quote, civil case. And then we also have the criminal case. Now, here's the interesting thing. Judge Crenshaw, Adam covered this excellently, as he always does. Judge Crenshaw, despite the government saying you must keep Abrego Garcia in federal detention while his criminal case is pending, Judge Crenshaw, independently upon motion by the lawyers for Abrego Garcia, found that Mr. Abrego Garcia, despite the government claiming he's a member of Tren de Aragua and is some horrible gang person, this federal judge says, nope, I don't find him to be a danger to the community. I'm going to let him out of custody while he's pending his criminal case to go to trial. But then the DOJ did what, Adam? What did the DOJ do to try to get him back into custody?
Well, it was a kind of combination. It's what they claimed not to have the power to do, because what happened is after Kilmer Abrego Garcia won two court rulings, one from a magistrate judge and one from a district judge, saying, no, he's not MS-13 member. No, he's not a danger to the community or a risk of flight. In fact, the government wants him out of the country, so he's definitely not a risk of flight. After he won that, the DOJ said, well, we can't help it if the Department of Homeland Security tries to deport him. And so after one weekend of a brief reunion with his family in Maryland, he has to check in to an ICE facility in Baltimore, where he is immediately put into detention, first in Virginia, currently in Pennsylvania, near Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania. No one knows why he was moved there. He is under a court order that he cannot be a certain distance from the court in Maryland. So he's still within that distance, but he's moved away without explanation. And what happened there, Katie, there is this remarkable thing where they, right before he was released from criminal custody, the government extends him a plea offer, says, if you plead guilty to these charges, we'll let you go to Costa Rica, which is a human rights respecting country that has guaranteed we won't send you back to El Salvador where you face persecution. If you basically stand on your right, if you go and take what you have earned, your right to pretrial release, then we'll send you to Uganda. So there was this rock and hard place. There was this coercion that was happening, but Kilmar Abrego Garcia's choice was to be released.
To fight it.
And he went back to his family for that weekend, checked in, surrendered to the ICE facility in Baltimore, and he has been in immigration custody since that time. The government has dropped its ambition to send him to Uganda. Now it is aiming for Eswatini, the last absolute monarchy on the African continent.
You know, folks, as you guys hear this recitation of the facts, I want to emphasize, Adam is telling you the facts. This is not spin. These are facts. It seems so obvious on the face of these facts that Kilmar Abrego Garcia is being vindictively prosecuted. But there has to be a system, and he has to work his way through the system to be able to achieve an end result. There are thousands upon thousands of people that have been stolen, kidnapped off of U.S. soil and taken to places we can't even account. Look, we've got almost 1,200 people from Alligator Alcatraz that we can't account for right now. I understand Kilmar Abrego Garcia is one of so many, but this is important for us because he's creating more legal headway for these fights to be had in these courts. And you'll also remember too, Adam, and to our viewers, that the United States government sued the entire federal bench in Maryland because of an administrative standing order that was entered by the chief judge that pretty much said, if you get one of these types of cases, the Trump DOJ can't try to end run people's due process. So you cannot just summarily have these people sent away. So the Trump administration sues the entire freaking federal bench in Maryland, which includes Judge Paula Zenas. And what happened to that, Adam, when they tried to do that?
It gets thrown out. And it's funny, I've always said when it came to that lawsuit, I remember when, you know, I was cutting my teeth as a reporter in a federal court, and you'd sometimes come across some crazy pro se filings where people, you know, sue everyone under the sun and all the judges and all of, you know, it read like that sort of complaint. So everyone knew it was going to, that it was going to crash and burn, this particular federal lawsuit against the entire district.
But who the hell sues all of the freaking judges? And the crazy thing was like, hey, judge, you need to decide about me suing you. It was just kind of crazy and wackadoo. I mean, eventually all those judges recused themselves, right? But I mean, at the end of the day, it ends up getting kicked out. So, Adam, the conclusion of this order is the following. For now, the court will grant Abrego's request for discovery, which I love. We all love discovery, right, people? And an evidentiary hearing. The parties must meet and confer on the proper narrow scope of discovery. So, people, before we get super, super excited, it's still great news, but it's going to be narrow discovery. Consistent with this memorandum opinion, as the parties work together to define the parameters, the court believes that a letter that was sent by Abrego to the government is a good place to start. And this order, it says an appropriate order will enter. I mean, Adam, talk about, though, what this discovery could look like, even in a narrowed sense.
So we know that the most compelling piece of evidence, it appeared, from this ruling involved Todd Blanche. So I'm going to be very interested to see how much they can look into Todd Blanche's role in this. And remember, I said a little bit earlier, there's another pending vindictive prosecution motion filed by Congresswoman LaMonica McGivern in New Jersey. And in her motion, she notes that that she, now remember, her prosecution resulted from the visit that she and the Newark mayor, Ross Baraka, and other congressional representatives paid to an immigration detention center called Delaney Hall. Mm-hmm. In what that she gleaned during discovery, she gleaned a body cam video showing someone saying, per the order of the deputy attorney general, so we can
Todd Blanche.
Exactly. So we could have two cases where vindictive prosecutions tied directly to Trump's former lawyer, who's the number two in the Justice Department, and discovery and evidentiary hearings could be ordered. So that's what's happening.
And I bet you if you got discovery in that James Comey indictment, I bet you $1 million Todd Blanche's fingerprints are all over that Lindsey Halligan shit. I bet you $1 million.
Right, right. I mean, this is a, you know, the judge ordered an evidentiary hearing and discovery. And I know that for a lot of folks who are watching this, that might seem incremental, but it's huge. This
huge.
This means that a criminal defendant can look into the origins of their case to see if the government has specifically and vindictively targeted them. And it could go to some of the highest officials at the DOJ. This is an extraordinarily rare ruling, and that it is not isolated. There could be, this could be the beginning of multiple rulings like it, because there are other pending motions of this nature, and certainly more coming. You mentioned Jim Comey. He's going to court for his arraignment late next week. We will see how his lawyers pursue, choose to litigate this, but I would not be in the least bit surprised if they pursue a vindictive prosecution motion. I mean, how could they not on this set of facts? Everything we know about the pushing out of Eric Siebert, the installing of Lindsey Halligan, and the existence of the memo where career prosecutors said there's not a case here. That's a case that's crying out for a motion like this. So I think that, yes, this is a very significant event in the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, but I think it's just the beginning.
You know, for those of you that had just tuned in, all 2,500 plus of you, thank you for being here. But I want to thank Adam Klassfeld, who truly is tip of spear when it comes to breaking news on all things legal. As you see, I call him the walking wounded. Guy's in a sling, but he wanted you all to have the latest breaking news, which is the following. A federal judge in Kilmer Abrego Garcia's criminal case in Tennessee has found that he has met the legal burden to get discovery, as Adam just discussed, as well as an evidentiary hearing concerning his vindictive prosecution by the Trump administration's DOJ, led by Pamela Joe, with specific citations in the federal order to Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, one of Trump's law lackeys, and I don't call him former personal counsel. If y'all know me, he's still the personal lawyer, just like Pamela Joe, Emil Bovey, Lindsey Halligan, and others. Adam, you rest up. For those of you that missed this will be posted on Adam and Mine's Substack profiles. There's a ticker that's going by. Make sure that you subscribe to Adam Klassfeld. He really is all things wonderful when it comes to not only the law, but even some politics as well. Adam, my friend, I'm grateful for you as always. Thanks for this.
Thank you. Grateful for you too, Katie.
All righty, folks. Have a good weekend. We're ending it. We're ending the week with some good news. Find some peace, people, over the weekend. I'll see you guys later.
We've been listening to Allison Gill and Adam Klassfeld discuss the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, a man from El Salvador who had been illegally abducted by the Trump Department of Homeland Security and then illegally prosecuted by the Trump administration's Department of Justice. And up next is some news about the humanitarian flotilla that was attempting to deliver humanitarian supplies to Gaza, and which was plucked from international waters by the Navy of Israel and sent back to their homes without reaching Gaza. But our commenter from the internet, one Kurnow Damo, is explaining, going to explain to us that this attack on the flotilla has backfired as Colombia has come out swinging against Israel.
Right, so Israel's navy didn't meet the summoned flotilla with courage, it met it with cowardice. Warships against fishing boats, drones against sacks of flour, commandos dragging away unarmed activists in international waters. It was piracy dressed up as policy, and law-breaking paraded as self-defence, all while the world watched, not least including Spanish and Italian warships that did absolutely nothing to uphold the law and defend civilians trying to break a siege and expose war crimes. But with that said, though, Israel exposed itself and faces a reckoning for it now. And amongst the responses from around the world one way or another, from various governments, one of the strongest anti-Israel moves came from Colombia. Gustavo Petro didn't hold back and showed leadership, showed moral fortitude, showed he's not going to accept Israeli impunity by expelling every Israeli diplomat left in the country, tearing up the free trade deal they held with Israel and calling the seizures what they were, crimes. Combined with Petro's recent call for US soldiers to disobey Trump and obey humanity over Israel, with Washington lashing back by revoking his visa, they've only ended up looking petty. But of course, if a country of Colombia's stature can make the right political choices here, what excuse do larger economies and militaries have not to? Right, so there are moments in history when the script gets flipped, when the supposedly weak do what the supposedly mighty dare not. That is what has just happened with Colombia. At a time when Gaza is being starved, when aid ships have been boarded, when an entire population is held under siege, it was not the great humanitarian powers of Europe or North America that stood up, it was Bogota. It was Gustavo Petro, a president leading a country long tethered to Washington's foreign policy, who decided that enough was enough. He has expelled all of Israel's remaining diplomats in the country. He's cancelled the free trade agreement. He has declared that the detention of Colombian citizens on the summit flotilla is an international crime. And all, of course, in the wake of telling American soldiers to obey humanity and not Donald Trump. So the scene that set this in motion was, of course, the interception of the summit flotilla, the convoy of civilian boats that were carrying food and medicine and baby milk and flour and, of course, lots of solidarity activists from across the world. Israel has always liked to present its blockade of Gaza as airtight, as an unbreakable wall of legality and military dominance. Yet the very fact that dozens of civilian boats could sail out together and head towards Palestinian waters explodes just how fragile that claim is. And a couple of boats managing to reach Palestinian waters absolutely detonated it, even if they didn't quite make it shore. Israeli destroyers scrambled after fishing boats. Drones harassed fishing vessels. Commandos stormed ships, dragging away figures as high-profile as European parliamentarians and Greta Thunberg and Nelson Mandela's grandson, but also many more, including many less well-known activists from Colombia, from Chile, from Turkey, from Spain, and lots of other countries besides. In Colombia, the word that stuck was kidnapping. These were not combatants seized on the battlefield. They were citizens of a sovereign country snatched in international waters. So when news reached Bogota that Colombian activists were among the detained, Petro did not wait for polite consultations. He acted. He denounced the detentions as an international crime. He ordered every last Israeli diplomat out of Colombia. He severed the free trade agreement that Israel had trumpeted for years as a symbol of its global nationalism. He announced legal action. So this was not the gradual escalation of a cautious partner here. This was a clean break. One day Israel had an embassy in Bogota, a trade treaty, and a partner in Latin America, and the next day it had nothing. The move stunned international observers precisely because of who Colombia is. This is not Bolivia or Venezuela, which are states that long sit in that camp of being defiant. This was Colombia, the keystone of Plan Colombia, the longtime anchor of US strategy in South America, the country that for decades was described as Washington's most reliable partner. Colombia has been used as the model for security cooperation, the site of US military bases, the loyal ally at the United Nations. If even Colombia is now breaking with Israel, what does that say about the fragility of Tel Aviv's alliances? Petro framed his actions not as a political gamble, though, but as legal obligation, which of course it is. Under Common Article 1 of the Geneva Conventions, every state is obliged not only to respect humanitarian law itself, but to ensure its respect by others. To sit idle while Israel blockaded aid, starved a population, and detained foreign citizens would itself risk complicity. The International Law Commission's articles on state responsibility are very clear on this matter. No state may aid or assist another in internationally wrongful acts. So by cancelling trade, Petro was signalling that Colombia would not risk becoming complicit in genocide. This was not an isolated act of presidential bravado either. In Bogota, thousands took to the streets. Protests erupted within hours of the flotilla news. Unlike European leaders who have ignored months of mass demonstrations in their own capitals calling for a ceasefire, Petro moved in step with his people. Presidents and prime ministers are supposed to be representative of ordinary people, aren't they? The people that vote for them in. But it's always a novelty when one actually proves that to be the case. He channeled their outrage into policy. He listened to them. Prior to all of this, of course, in New York, before the UN, Petro uttered the words that would bring Washington itself into direct confrontation. He called on American soldiers to disobey Trump. He told them to obey humanity instead of unlawful orders. This was a Latin American head of state telling US troops not to be complicit in war crimes, to make their own choices. And the echoes of history here were, of course, deafening. Every Latin American nation knows the cost of American soldiers following orders. Coups, massacres, occupations baked into their histories. Petro put it quite plainly, legality and morality must come before obedience. The United States reacted as empire always reacts to insubordination, though, with a punishment. The State Department revoked Petro's visa. It was a deliberate humiliation, a way of signalling that even a head of state could be treated like a misbehaving subject by them. Petro's foreign minister renounced her own visa in solidarity. Petro responded by accusing Washington of violating international law by punishing speech, and he also reminded the world that he happens to hold European citizenship as well, and therefore could travel regardless. So the message was simple. Colombia was not going to be grovelling, and Trump could stick his revocation where the sun doesn't shine. But let's pause on the legal point here, because it matters. The Nuremberg Principles enshrined after the Holocaust declared that just following orders is no defence to war crimes. Soldiers have a duty to disobey unlawful orders. Petro was not being incendiary for the sake of it. He was repeating the foundational principle of modern humanitarian law. In Bosnia versus Serbia in 2007, the International Court of Justice went further, affirming that states have a duty not just to avoid committing genocide, but to actively prevent it. By calling out both Israel and Washington, Petro was applying the law consistently, therefore. His critics in Washington might dismiss him, but they cannot claim he's wrong on the law. And the consequences of these actions ripple out in three directions: towards Israel, towards the United States, and towards Colombia itself. For Israel, the loss of Colombia might not be economically devastating. Trade volumes were modest, but the symbolism is still crippling. Israel has spent years trying to present itself as normalized, integrated, no longer a pariah. The Abraham Accords with Gulf states were trumpeted as proof that isolation was over. The free trade agreement with Colombia was another trophy. Petro smashed that trophy on the floor. He turned Israel's narrative of expansion into a story of rupture instead, and he did so from a country that had been seen as a loyal ally. That tells the world that Israel's isolation is real, it is deepening, and no longer confined to the predictable critics. It also adds to Israel's legal exposure. Every time a state declares Israeli actions an international crime, every time a country recalls an ambassador or expels diplomats, it strengthens the argument before the ICJ and ICC that Israel is committing grave breaches. Petro's words are now part of that record. They make it harder for Israel to hide behind claims of self-defense. For Washington, the risks are even greater. Colombia has been their jewel of US influence to South America. To lose Bogota's obedience is to admit that even the most reliable partners can defect, and they have. Revoking Petro's visa might feel like a show of strength in Washington from bully boy Trump, but abroad, it just looks petty and imperial, a desperate attempt to punish disobedience. It plays into Petro's framing perfectly. The empire cannot tolerate humanity before obedience to them. And it shows other states that defiance is possible too. If Colombia can stand up, why not Brazil? Why not Mexico? Why not Chile? Washington might think it is disciplining Petro, but they just look pathetic. For Colombia, the gamble still carries risks, though. The financial press may talk a capital flight, then domestic elites aligned with Washington may step up in their opposition. Petro might be painted as reckless in some media circles, but the rewards are significant too. At home, he stands as a leader who's shown he listens to his people and protects his citizens abroad. Exactly what you want in a leader, isn't it? Internationally, he gains stature as a statesman willing to act on principle. And geopolitically, Colombia positions itself as part of a new multipolar alignment, open to partnerships with BRICS, with the Arab world, with Africa. In the long run, the reputational gain might outweigh the economic risks in the short term. But the deepest consequence of all is the exposure of Western hypocrisy. If Colombia can do this, then why not Germany? Why not Britain? Why not Canada? Or even the United States itself? These countries have infinitely more resources. They have the power to impose arms embargoes, to cut trade, to enforce sanctions. Instead, they enable Israel's genocide. Germany invokes its history to justify sending weapons to the very machinery of starvation and bombardment. Britain's Labour leadership, branding itself progressive, criminalises protest while allowing jet parts and more to flow to Tel Aviv. Canada cloaks itself in human rights rhetoric but votes against ceasefire resolutions. The European Union just keeps wringing its hands and talks about both sides while refusing to block arms. And the United States, with that veto power they have, ensure that no binding resolution ever passes the UN Security Council. None of these states can plead helplessness, though. They are complicit, and their complicity is their choice. They choose to prioritise arms sales. They choose to bow to lobby power. They choose to maintain imperial alliances. Their silence is not necessity, it is cowardice, and Petro, by acting, has exposed them for cowards. If Colombia can, they can. That they will not shows them for what they are. Not progressive, not humane, but complicit, and in need of their own day in the dock of The Hague. The broader questions flow from here as well. What does this mean for Latin America as a whole? In many ways, it's a return to form. The continent has a history of defiance from Cuba's revolution to the Bolivarian alliance. Bolivia cut ties with Israel last year. Chile and Honduras recalled ambassadors. Brazil's Lula has spoken more and more bluntly. With Colombia joining the chorus, the region is gaining momentum here. A bloc of Latin American states could form a moral counterweight to Western hypocrisy, amplifying the case for Palestine in international forums. So what does it mean for the global order? In a multipolar world, symbolism matters as much as hard power does. A small state acting with courage can tilt narratives. Colombia's actions resonate far beyond Bogota. They are heard in Africa, where states remember colonial arrogance. They're heard in Asia, where Western lectures on law ring hollow. They are heard in the Arab world, where solidarity with Palestine is central. By acting, Colombia elevates itself, not economically, but morally, into the ranks of states that set the standard. And what does it mean for Palestinians themselves? Beyond geopolitics, there's the human effect. In Gaza, where people live under bombardment, under siege, starved by design, every act of solidarity matters. When a country as distant as Colombia stands up for them, it tells Palestinians they are not forgotten. It tells them that their struggle resonates across oceans. It gives hope in a time of despair. And finally, what does this mean for the very idea of progressivism? Western leaders love to call themselves progressive. They speak of equality, of climate justice, of diversity. Yet faced with genocide, they falter instead. Their progressivism is hollow, confined to domestic rhetoric, erased at their own borders. True progressivism always comes at a cost. It means saying no even when it hurts. It means risking trade, risking aid, risking diplomatic convenience. Colombia has shown what that looks like. By contrast, the so-called progressives of Europe and North America have been exposed as utter hypocrites. And so we begin, return right to the beginning. Israel thought it was detaining activists. Instead, it detonated a rupture with Colombia, and who knows who else will follow. Washington thought it was disciplining Petro. Instead, it made him a symbol of defiance. The powerful thought they could hide behind rhetoric. Instead, they've been unmasked. Colombia has done what they would not. It has said no. No to genocide. No to complicity. No to empire's demand for their obedience. History will not forget that difference. It will not forget who stood silent with all their power and who, with far less, dared to act. If Colombia can, they can. That they do not is the proof of their own guilt. And of course, it's not just diplomatically where Israel is finding itself getting punished now, but economically and financially too. Israel's markets are seeing a bit of a run on the shekel, you might say. Investor flight is building, and before long, they might well find it a little bit tougher to borrow at affordable rates. Israel figured the markets only cared about money, not Gaza. Turns out they were wrong. Check out this video recommendation here as your suggested next watch to find out all about how wrong they were. Please do also hit like, share and subscribe if you haven't done so already, so as to ensure you don't miss out on all new daily content, as well as spreading the word and helping support the channel at the very same time, which is of course very much appreciated. Holding power to account for ordinary working class people. And I'll hopefully catch you on the next vid.
And that was Kurnow Damo from the internet talking about the consequences of Israel's abducting the flotilla that was trying to provide humanitarian aid to Gaza. And finally today, we're going to hear my brother Paul Tinkerhess, is his last name, Paul Tinkerhess, and his performance at a hands-off rally in Ann Arbor, Michigan, back in April of this year. A song called The Power and the Glory. It's adapted from Phil Oakes by my brother, Paul Tinkerhess. So here he is.
Paul is an amazing musician who is going to end our rally today playing the banjo. A machine that just so happens to kill fascists. Thank you, Yusuf. I'm glad to bring some music into this, and I hope as we go forward in this movement, there will be more and more music.
Yeah.
I hope that, well, how many musicians are there here? And how many people plan to take up music at the earliest possibility? Good. Just the auto harp, you know, whatever it takes. And, you know, there's Facebook and all that, but I think how this moves forward is in face-to-face, from somebody's mouth to somebody's ear. Just plan a little thing. Once a month, you get together with your neighbors and sing songs, that kind of thing. Because we're going to win this thing, you know. It's every rain cloud runs out of rain eventually, they say. And as Bernie says, the good thing about the 1% is they're only 1%. You know, we got that on. There's one from Phil Oaks. Let's see if I... Here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall, but her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Her glory shall rest on the song. Now this land is troubled by those who lie in hate. They try to take our freedom and gamble with our fate. Their money is their weapon and treason is their crime. But we can't stop them if we try. Here is the land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. But her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Her glory shall rest on us all, on us all. From Colorado, Kansas, to the Carolinas, too, Virginia and Alaska, they're protesting too. From Texas and Ohio to the San Francisco Bay, we're all in the streets today. Here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. But her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Her glory shall rest on the sun, on the sun.